You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist. And I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have a special guest. We have Sean Prophet. Sean Prophet was vice president of a millenarian cult that predicted nuclear war and prepared to survive it, building massive, massive underground bomb shelters and stockpiling lots of food and weapons for thousands of followers. My Cult, Your Cult is his book, and it's part insider case study and part personal reckoning. Prophet was born into the Church Universal and Triumphant, sometimes called CUT, C-U-T, which began as the Summit Lighthouse. And the cult was founded in 1958 by his father, Mark Prophet, and later led by his mother, Elizabeth Clare Prophet, both of whom claimed to channel ascended masters, people who came before us to teach us, like of the Muhammad, Jesus, Moses ilk. CUT drew from theosophy, from yoga, Rosicrucianism, and the mighty I Am movement, a lineage steeped in spiritual elitism and racialized mythology and definitely authoritarian control. During its most extreme period, Prophet held a position of apparent authority as CUT's vice president, yet he remained firmly under his mother's spiritual dominance, constrained by a system of secrecy and loyalty and manipulation. In 1987, Elizabeth Clare Prophet predicted a Soviet nuclear strike for 1989, setting in motion one of the largest private bomb shelter construction efforts in American history. When the prophecy failed, he left the organization and began the long process of confronting his complicity and emerging as one of its sharpest critics. The book draws powerful parallels between Cutts' apocalyptic dogma and the authoritarian tactics of contemporary movements, including MAGA and Christian nationalism and online cults like QAnon. Prophet's analysis show how cults and authoritarian governments are alike and how they weaponize divine claims to exploit fear and suppress dissent and dismantle human rights. There is an audiobook companion that goes along with his book, which I suggest everyone have a listen to. Here is Sean Knapp. I am so happy to be able to speak to Sean Prophet today and to have all of you hear part of his story and find out about him and his incredible book that covers so many wonderful subjects with depth and finding what is linked to other things that sometimes can be surprising. Before we get into the whole discussion, I would love for you to take a moment to introduce yourself to those listening, and then we'll get started.
Thank you so much, Rachel, for having me on. My name is Sean Prophet, and I'm the author of My Cult, Your Cult. It discusses the cult that was started by my parents, Mark and Elizabeth Prophet. And it's a book that covers not only my story, but also a lot of theory, psychology, ethics, talks about authoritarianism, totalitarianism, and how cults destroy truth and bolster authoritarian power. That's the subtitle.
I love it. It's reminding me of Stephen Colbert has this phrase he calls truthiness.
Yeah.
Sort of like truth adjacent, right? Sort of sounds like it, but it goes off the rails. And within certain environments, that just doesn't matter because the truth is whatever the leader says, and it can change from one day to the next. And then it's the new truth, which is very difficult for people to grasp or for you to feel like you can master the system. It kind of keeps people, I think, feeling a little bit on edge and needing to know what's going to be true next and how they're going to be able to get something right that was wrong yesterday. I mean, everything, it's like tectonic plate shifts under your feet so often is how a lot of people talk to me about it. So I just wanted to let you know, because we haven't talked before, that I started doing this work in the late 80s during a monumental shift in your life and in the life of Church Universal and Triumphant, otherwise known as CUT, as you know, but just for the listeners, that's what we're talking about. I found out a lot about what was happening during that time, predicting the end of the world. I've worked with a lot of people who have been in groups where it was apocalyptic, where they didn't plan for their future, where they didn't have a plan because who knew if things were going to be around, and that it was so much about protecting your life, protecting the planet if you could, this sense of urgency, and all crafted, all made up. And then when that reality comes crashing down, it's a very hard one, and a lot of people leave similar to the timing that you left and you made that shift, which I do want to talk to you about. And I also wanted to let you know that I use your mom, Elizabeth Clare Prophet, as an example of how to speak in a hypnotic way. And I used to have cassettes. Okay, does that show how old I am? I used to have cassettes of her talking, and also with the teachings that were repeated and faster till it sort of sounded like bees buzzing, and that she had this cadence of speaking in a certain way that really drew people in, that I think felt to me in retrospect planned, formulaic. She had a way of talking that felt deliberate, that felt superior, and that was also hypnotic. So there is a lot that I've heard about the group, and also people I've treated who were either born and raised in it or were brought in by their parents and lived a very interesting life in terms of not being able to do any self-care and limited food and resources and being under fear. It did a number. And then, this is my long intro, just so you can orient yourself to what I know and so you can feel comfortable bringing it up. I've also worked with a lot of people who are part of these sort of legacy families, the children of, the grandchildren of, in some cases, the great-grandchildren of. There's a certain burden that's held by you, by others. And I can't speak specifically for yours because we haven't heard about yours yet, but there's very often this fall from being on high, but also that there is moral injury. What was I a part of? And what do I need to pay for because of it or make up for what my parents did or created? It's heady and it's a lot to put on someone's shoulders. I give you so much credit for being able to be out there and telling the story and doing what you can to do education, prevention, but also broadening the conversation so people see that this isn't just about Church Universal and Triumphant. It's about bigger things. I would love to hear from you about kind of a day in the life, if you remember when you were growing up. So we get a picture of little Sean and what it was like in your life when you were small.
When I was small, it was all I knew. There was no sense of, it took a little while to develop that sense of insider versus outsider because this was my world. So I did begin to become aware that we were not like other people. And particularly when I started going to a local elementary school. Now, you have to picture I was in Colorado Springs and we were in the Broadmoor area of Colorado Springs, which is the Beverly Hills of Colorado Springs. So it's a very wealthy neighborhood and we had a huge mansion, the largest one in the neighborhood. And of course, we had about anywhere between 30 and 60 people living there at any given time. So I show up at elementary school, dropped off in a green Cadillac by a Black staff member. And I'm wondering why these kids all think I'm weird. They're making jokes about my house. The walls are made of poop, things like that. It was clear to me at that time that the kids, they kind of had it in for me and I didn't know why. So a lot of times I'd ask my mom, you know, why are the kids all mean to me? Oh, they're jealous of you. And then sometimes she would say, it's because of your light. You're different. You're chosen. You're part of the chosen people. We're separate from that. That's how I began to become aware of this separateness.
Wow. It's so interesting. Also the phrase, they're jealous of you. I hear that a lot from parents who have a more narcissistic leaning, that that's the explanation. They're jealous of you because I think that's the wish on their part, that people are going to look at their life and be jealous of what they have.
Says we're better. Says we're better than them. And that was the whole thing. We were the light bearers and the outsiders were the fallen ones. So yeah, it's very, very much hierarchical. Us versus them, insider versus outsider, in-group, out-group, however you want to refer to it. That distinction was very, very clear. You touched on a lot of things in the intro. And I just, you know, what do you want to talk about first? You mentioned truthiness at the beginning. And I think truthiness is whatever serves the authoritarian agenda or whatever serves the person's psychological agenda. Because remember, people getting into cults, they need something, they want something, they're looking for something. And they feel at that point that it meets a legitimate need. And in some cases, it does. I mean, you get a certain sense of belonging, you get a certain sense of meaning. And I think the trouble comes in, what do you give up in order to get that? Is the price too high? Have you mortgaged yourself to get this benefit?
Wow, what a great phrase. My goodness, have you mortgaged yourself to get that benefit? At what cost? Wow, have you mortgaged yourself? I'm gonna write that down, give you credit if and when I ever use it. I think it is really incredible that you also, I mean, you paint a picture just that experience at school, that it's very isolating and confusing about why you're being received that way, but also that you're in then two worlds.
Completely. I mentioned this in my book, Code Switching. You have to figure out how to be in that other environment and to talk like them. I didn't know anything about popular music. I didn't know how to play various childhood games that kids learn. There was just a lot of jargon that I wasn't exposed to. And of course, they didn't know what I was talking about. If I brought up any of my experiences or talk about my life, of course, they didn't seem to care. I was so much of an outsider. I had a hard time making friends and it was just tough.
Right. And you have, I know, about a sister. How many siblings do you have?
I have 4 siblings, actually.
4 siblings. Okay. I think I heard your sister speak at a conference. And I'm wondering about how it was growing up with siblings. Were they having the same experience? Were they going to school outside in the same way you were?
What happened is that my dad was very much, he was ultra conservative. And if you know about how these things are working right now with school boards and how ultra conservative parents are either trying to pull their kids out of school or they're trying to get on the school board and change what's being taught, ban books and things like that. That's kind of how my dad was. And he pulled me out of school in the middle of 4th grade and started our own school. So by the time my sisters were of school age, they were younger and they went to our school. They never went to public school. So I was the only one who actually had that experience because I'm the oldest.
Okay. Even though that experience was a hard one and alienating and lonely, it's still really important. It's kind of more of a frame of reference for what the rest of the world is like.
Oh, yeah.
Pop culture references, those kinds of things that you were exposed to.
You hear this a lot from educators that equally important to the academics is socialization. As a child, if you don't get that socialization, this is why I have such a problem with the homeschool movement, because even if you can, I mean, it's very hard as a parent to do everything else and be there as an educator for your child. I mean, that's like an extremely tall order. But even if you could do that, the kids are missing out on the whole idea of going to school and is to find out alternative perspectives from your parents. If you're just home all the time, you're only getting one perspective. So being with other kids, having those rough edges rounded off, those are all important reasons to be in school. And of course, once I got pulled out of public school and back in our cult school, I had none of that. I mean, I did have the other kids, but I was no longer able to understand and participate in a different reality.
So tell me, it might be hard because you were young when the shift was made, but what was the difference in curriculum? Why was it important for your dad and or your mom to create something where it was really a very controlled amount of information about, I'm sure, only certain subjects? What was it like?
We did have a full academic education. And the funny thing is that I was tutored before I went to elementary school. So I was already like kind of academically ahead in some areas. I was a year early and then I skipped 2nd grade. So I was in public school 7 and 3rd grade or something like that. I think my dad's main objection was very much, you hear a lot of these MAGA people saying today about wokeness. And at that time, it was called sensitivity training and diversity training, those kind of things. And he thought those were all, you know, communist plot. It was very, very similar to MAGA. He was a John Bircher, extremely conservative. Everything bothered him. And he would have arguments with the principal of the school. And he was a very outspoken guy.
You see that a lot with parents. I'm sometimes called by the children of, sometimes even high schoolers, who are saying, especially during COVID years, and I don't mean to make people think that COVID is gone, but still, when it all erupted, people were calling me saying, help, my mom, who was really peaceful when I was growing up, just lunged at one of the other parents at a PTA meeting because she's now in QAnon and she needs to save the children. And I don't know what's going on. So there is this militant piece that gets exposed in people because I think they are so frightened. I mean, in ways that were conjured up, really, but that they really need to keep their children safe and the world safe. And I think it comes out in aggression.
Let's be clear. QAnon is a total psyop. It's hard to say who exactly is responsible for it. And there's been so much about this that's been talked about on the Conspirituality podcast. And, you know, other people have talked plenty about this, Jim Stewartson. This was an effort by enemies of democracy, enemies of the United States, to undermine our democracy. And the worst part about it is that the people that it supposedly benefits, like Donald Trump, are the ones most guilty of pedophilia. It's almost like it was just a diversion from the Epstein scandal. Like, if you think about for the enemies of the United States, what better thing than to have neighbor against neighbor, people lunging at each other at PTA meetings in small town America? our society is being torn apart by this disinformation. And it's so funny because if you ever watched Homeland on that show, it's exactly the same thing. I mean, they laid out the entire plot there, and QAnon is exactly that disinformation, and along with all the rest of it. I mean, it never stops, but you can be guaranteed the stuff's coming from who knows what countries, Moldovan or Russian troll farms, this kind of thing. They're just whipping it up. They're just amplifying these divisions. We could not have been conquered as a nation unless we did it to ourselves. And that's what's kind of happening right now with MAGA and with the conspiracy theories like QAnon and all the rest of them. I mean, QAnon also goes back to blood libel. These are ancient tropes that have been recycled and recirculated, and people who don't know about them are going to be susceptible to them, because who isn't concerned about child rape? It's the worst possible thing. Other than genocide or torture, I mean, child rape is literally the worst thing human beings can do to each other. So you take that and you turn that into a conspiracy theory, and you got some pretty pissed off people.
Yes, you do. There's so many interesting memes out there, but I remember seeing one that was a dialogue, very short dialogue, and one person says to the other, "It's amazing that Trump wants Greenland. Do you realize how big Greenland is?" And the other person says, "Yeah, I heard it's about 98% big enough to cover up the Epstein files." Let's just keep coming back. Let's keep coming back to where we need to be focused before we are taken off course. It's reminding me also of a woman you'd probably enjoy speaking with, Olga Kurkova, who was running an organization or helping to run an organization called StopFake.org. It's a Ukrainian organization. Just before the war broke out, we talked, and she was really concerned that war was going to break out, because what she noticed was, through Russian infiltration into media, that Ukrainians were turning on each other. And she said, this is what happens. She knew at some point, while everyone is focused on each other, Russians were going to be doing their thing, infiltrating, and no one was going to be keeping guard and watching out, because they were so busy seeing each other as the enemy. And it is an age-old technique. It's also true with blood libel. I mean, it's very hard for me, as someone who is Jewish, and proudly so, that you hear about these organizations, even flat earthers, where it suddenly becomes anti-Semitic. And I think, what? And then you hear about the Jewish space lasers. Like, how does it find its way into all these old tropes? And when are they going to go away? I feel like they're so embedded in our psyches as human beings.
Well, once you lose the tether to reality, then all of these things, first of all, I mean, the whole idea of anti-Semitism or racism of any kind, it's completely unscientific concept, first of all. There's nothing different. I mean, we're so closely related to all human beings. The concept of race is more of a cultural thing, really. And it also just had to do with geography. People migrated to Northern Europe and lost their skin color. It's just, we're all the same. We all came from Africa. All these cultural divisions, they just benefit the powerful. I mean, if you want to rule people, keep them at each other's throats. So when you take something as ridiculous as flat earth or the stupid conspiracies that everybody should be able to know are false, it's like there's a motivation. Basically, what they're saying is truth is not the boss of me. I can believe whatever I want. If I want to think that 2 + 2 = 5, that's my choice, my opinion. And that right there is what cult leaders ride in on. That's why it skews authoritarian, because if truth isn't the boss, then the leader is the boss, and the leader can change their mind. It's what you said in your introduction. You're tap dancing from one foot to the other to try to figure out what's true today. And once you've lost that tether, I hold myself accountable to what's true. That's a tough stance to take in a cult, because you will immediately get social pressure. People who are flat earthers used to face ultimate ridicule, but now they've found each other on the internet and they can ridicule mainstream science as if there's something wrong with it, and they have a higher truth. This is all what cults are about, is the higher truth that's not accountable to reality.
Right. I remember seeing this button that someone was wearing, and it was printed by NASA, and it said, "It's round. We checked." I loved it, to the point. there's so much now that's funny and sad at the same time that it's even necessary. But the idea of truth is interesting too, because people also, I've been doing work with people who have been involved in cults for 35 years. And over time, I've expanded it to include people who have been in relationships with and or raised by narcissists.
Relationships can be a cult of two.
Absolutely right. And so when you start to hear these stories, I mean, people actually came to me saying, I heard you talk about cults. That sounded like my marriage. So they informed me about how similar it was, which was really interesting. I learned a lot over time by being open to hearing people say, this actually dovetails my life for these reasons. When you hear, let's say, a partner say, my husband told me I have to listen to him all the time because he's always right. So I listened to him. And the thing that I did, because I listened to him, actually backfired. And then he said, well, why did you listen to me? That's on you that you listened to me. I realized then.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's almost like it's not about the truth, but the truth in the situation is you will always be wrong and the person in charge will always be right. That feels like that's the truth.
Truth becomes an expression of loyalty. Nicki Minaj just declared that we hadn't been to the moon, you know, this typical thing. And it's almost as if in order to be thought well of in MAGA, you have to check all the boxes. We don't believe in COVID. We don't believe in climate change. We don't believe we landed on the moon. You know, we don't believe the earth is round. How extreme are you going to go? We had Trump, remember in his first term, he's looking at the eclipse just because people said, don't look at the eclipse. It becomes, you have to in some way declare that you're against the mainstream. You're against common knowledge. You're against common sense because the leader has the higher truth and loyalty is more important.
Right. Loyalty is kind of everything. I mean, I think that when people now are collecting data, it's so frustrating. I see this very reasonable people in the media or in government are collecting data so that they have enough, they think, to combat something that Trump is saying or that the government is saying. But the facts don't matter.
It's not about data. It's not about data at all.
Right.
It's about emotional truth. What is emotionally true for me right now? And I remember the first time this was really happening. I believe it was during it might have been during the 2016 election. I think they were interviewing Newt Gingrich when he was still around. And it was basically, they said, hey, crime statistics are dropping. Crime is lower than it's been. He said something like, well, that doesn't feel true. At that point, that was when the official, aside from Trump, the Republican Party started to basically declare independence from reality. It started long before that. It started with trickle-down economics. It goes all the way back, right? I mean, you can trace this back, you know, even prior to the civil rights movement. Data is not relevant when you're running on popularity. All of democracy itself is effectively argument from popularity, and majorities can be wrong about data.
Oh, that's so interesting. Every once in a while, I do something, and I know I'm going to get depressed doing it, but I do it anyway. And I will look at videos online or on TikTok, and I'll see, depending on certain leanings, how many are getting millions of views and how many just have a couple hundred. The ones that get millions are the ones that say, Israel never existed. It's a made-up idea. What? The ones who are combating that and saying, that's a crazy idea, they just have a few people watching because it's not as sexy. It's not as interesting. It's not as out there. And it's not as unifying among these people. I'm wondering also, going back to your upbringing, I'm sure you were raised with a lot of ideas as the truth. And some of them may have felt like they were kind of reasonable and some were really out there.
A lot of them were just aphorisms. Things that sounded true or felt true. I wanted to bring up one example from Trump when he said, they're eating the pets or Jewish space lasers or whatever it is. The reason why they get millions of interactions is because they're simple and outrageous. You need both. And that's what all of social media is geared toward. In our group, I make a list of our sort of aphorisms, thought-stopping cliches that we had in the group. Things like, obedience is better than sacrifice. It is better to be harmonious than right. Order is heaven's first law. these various cliches that just feel true, they sound true, and they stop any sort of thought.
Yeah. I was talking to someone recently. I was interviewing her for the podcast, and her episode will be out fairly soon. But she was saying that in her group, the leader had this idea about people being hostile, that he wanted people to give up their hostility. Of course, I think so that they could be more malleable and not reactive to him.
Yeah.
When he really made them hostile. But anything was considered that you were being hostile towards the world. So that if you asked a question, that was your hostility towards the world. If you were bored, that was your hostility towards the world. What?
Just more thought-stopping cliches. I mean, the fact of the matter is, anger is a protective emotion. It's very useful. It's highly motivating. And you don't have a choice, really, about whether you feel angry about something. Something happens to you, you get injured, or somebody betrays you or does you a wrong, you're going to feel angry. And of course, the cult leader will tell you that you have to transmute that anger. You have to let go, forgive and forget, all these cliches that make your feelings wrong. And feelings are extremely important. And we don't always have to act on them, but they're information. Somebody telling you that your feelings are invalid is gaslighting. You didn't experience what you experienced.
Right. I think it's also so telling that it's only your negative feelings that are a problem. They just don't want you to be angry. They don't want you to be sad about things. They're fine with you being in adoration of them, being happy, that they can handle. But it's very much like the narcissistic playbook. I want to do what I want to do, and I want to have no consequences, and I want to have no accountability. And as soon as you're upset, then you're making me accountable. I don't want that.
Anger is a part of the accountability cycle. It really is.
Okay. That's so interesting. It's like with Scientology and the reactive mind being so demonized. Like, no.
It's the same thing. They'll have different names for it, but it's the exact same thing.
Right. Exact same.
No pushback. Just accept. Just eat it up. Lick the spoon.
Right. So what was that like for you growing up? I'm just wondering, for you and people in CUT, if you were upset, even if you were hungry or tired, having actual physical responses to things, how was that all handled?
Well, you're supposed to use the violet flame. The violet flame is a certain type of decree that you do to transmute negative energy, to transmute the anger or whatever. It was very complicated. Like, my mother was into cosmic astrology, she called it, and the lines of the clock, and each line of the clock had various good and bad qualities. We would decree to be infused with the good and to cast out the bad. There was a whole casting out of the dweller on the threshold, which it's sort of a nebulous character, but it kind of refers to questioning or indecision, along with the shadow aspects of the self, the aspects that you would deny, like rage, like hatred, like all the things that are unacceptable and not godly. So all of those things were repressed for sure and condemned, and people would self-police. I'm feeling this anger or hatred right now. I need to go do some violet flame. They would go, say, an hour or 2 hours of decrees or whatever, and I guess they would feel better. Decrees never worked for me, and I don't think they worked for anyone. I never felt any difference. It was just boring and repetitious. As you mentioned earlier, it had the sound of like a drone of bees. Of course, if you're doing them all the time and if you learn them, you know exactly what those words are. It doesn't sound like a drone anymore because it's intelligible. But to most people, it's just absolutely alien sounding.
It's interesting. You were talking about things being simple and outrageous, which is so interesting because I think about these phrases and years later, decades later, people remember them. They will quote them and they'll say, I hate that it's still in my head, but it gets embedded. Even then, they didn't understand it because they'll say, what does that mean? I have no idea. Did you ever know? No, I had no idea.
Aphorism, a total aphorism. And the fact is that I still had this happen where I'll be hiking or I'll be riding my motorcycle or whatever it is. And suddenly some of these decrees will start coming into my head and I won't be able to get them out for a day or two. It's kind of like an old song. It just gets stuck. Your brain gets in this loop. And that demonstrates the power of how hypnotic this is and how people who get out of cults are impacted for life. It's not like this goes away. It's always there with you. I mean, that's true of all experiences, but these experiences are powerful because they represent you abdicated and then you had to reclaim yourself. And so that memory of all of that is going to continue to reverberate and takes a lot of time and work to really keep it at bay.
It does. And I think for a lot of people, it's depressing, or they think they're still in it somehow, or that it still has some power over them. And I think you're right that people are impacted for life. I do think it's important when that happens, like if you're on your motorcycle, enjoying a very free moment. I'm sure it's a huge drag to suddenly have these things pop up in your head. And then I think it's good to say, this doesn't mean something about me. It doesn't mean that I'm still there. It doesn't mean that I'm weak in some way, right? It means that my brain has the capability of doing what brains are capable of doing, which is if something is given to me and repeated over and over, I will memorize it. That means also that I could probably learn an instrument and I could learn a new language. And so what does this mean about me potentially in a positive way? Like, I wonder if a reframe is important at times.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the brain, these are physical synaptic patterns that are encoded. You have no control over that. If it's in there and it's coming out, I always think to myself, maybe this is one less time that I'm ever going to have to hear this for the rest of my life.
Oh, I like that response, actually. I think that's really good. But it's important to talk to yourself in some way that helps you feel a little reassured, or in some way that's a positive light. So interesting. I wonder also, before we move back into so many subjects that we've already gotten into, I'm sure people want to know a little bit more just about what your parents were like, because people are going to see the outward persona, the polished persona, the backlit with the aura persona, and then also what it's like to be in a room with someone who is channeling, because that is huge, again, on the internet. There are a lot of people who are channeling. So I'm just curious, from a behind the scenes view of your folks and also being in the room with an ascended master, or at least what you thought was an ascended master at the time.
Right. Well, you mentioned in the introduction about my mother's voice, that her voice was captivating. And it was. I mean, she was very charismatic. She had that ability to command. I mean, her voice was the most, at times it could be terrifying. There would be grown men twice her size that would tremble when she would speak to them. It was great power that she held, and she held it because people gave it to her. If you think about a cult leader without followers, they would just be somebody with strange ideas, possibly holding up a sign on a street corner. It's the followers. When you're in a room, say at a conference, say my mom's in a room with 1,000 people, if you're one of those people, you're looking at the 999 others and saying, there must be something going on here. This isn't just me. It's the audience that provides the reflection that creates the power. My sister actually talks about this in her work on charisma. It's an interactive bond and it has to be refreshed. And it is a power that is given by the audience. It's not just taken by the charismatic leader. So as far as what channeling is, I mean, I take a very hard line on this in the sense that I don't know exactly how this process worked, but according to everything we know about modern science and biology, psychology, every single word that came out of my mother's mouth came from her brain. There's no other place that it could have come from. The mind is what the brain does. It's this physical organ that's incredibly complex. We have something like 100 trillion synapses in our brain. And the interactions between those, and you start getting into the neurology, the ion channels, this and that, the way that new neurology can be created to do new things at any given time. I'm reading Sapolsky's book right now called Determined, and fantastic book. I won't get into that because that's not our topic. But what I will say is that everything that comes out of a channel's mouth is coming from them, not from an outside source. There's never been any evidence. There's no way to verify. There's no way to tell the difference between someone who is imagining a master versus if there actually was one. So if you can't test it, then there's no reason for anybody to be able to claim that it's true. We're in flat earth territory again. No amount of proof will convince someone who believes in a channel that they're actually just a human being talking. It's not about what's true or what can be proven. It's about what makes them feel good. People who follow channels are looking for answers, and they have to believe that those answers are superhuman, supernatural, because otherwise they're just listening to a person. So it's elevating this message to a higher authority, and it's all based on authority. I don't know how many different ways to say it.
it's similar to people who will say, you know, I'm speaking for God or God speaks through me. And so, well, then you can't argue because you can't disagree with God. But also, how do you prove it or disprove it? It's like Madame Blavatsky and her automatic writing. I agree with you. It came from her. There have been studies on different kinds of epilepsy that can cause people to feel like they're communing with spirits. And so who knows if it's a disorder or if it's just a fabrication, but either way, I'm with you. There's no proof that this exists, but you can see it now, unfortunately, online. A lot of people are getting a lot of followers saying that they are channeling lots of warriors, and it's only a problem if it's a problem. Fine, if someone wants to talk that way and say that they are channeling, but as soon as they want to have members, people being devoted to them, giving up their life for them, that's when it becomes a problem. That's why I try to keep my eye on it.
I'd like to ask a follower of a channel, how do you know this isn't performance art? How do you differentiate performance artist or an actor from a channel? How would you know? There are some great actors in the world. They have awards. The problem with channels is that they say that they're not acting. They claim that it's true. That's the part. I mean, scripture wouldn't be a problem if it was in the category of fiction. A channel wouldn't be a problem if they declared themselves to be a performance artist. It's the mixture, the declaration that these are real, true things that are happening, that's actually the fraud.
Oh, that's so interesting. I mean, I got this sort of, this chill went down my spine when I saw evangelists talking about Trump being the anointed one. And I thought, oh, no. Well, then he was sent by God. Great.
Can't be questioned.
Can't be questioned. That it's evil of you to even think about questioning. And then it just further insulates him in a way that he doesn't need anymore. And just to be clear to people listening, we're talking about Trump, but we're also talking about something larger, which is about perception, which is about, I think, narcissism, which is about totalitarianism, which is about how movements can keep going and grow without people understanding that how much they're forfeiting, how much they're giving up logic, all the things that sort of, in fact, the things that keep us safe. It's really frightening.
Authoritarians, cult leaders, they all have to have this huge personality, larger than life. I think a certain amount of that is getting caught up in your own myth. Because I do believe, from everything that I saw with my mother and my father, that they somehow sincerely believed that this was true, that they were who they said they were. That's where it gets tricky, because how do you prove motivation? How do you get inside someone's head and get, are they really faking or do they believe this is real? I think with my mom, it was, I think she actually thought she was an anointed messenger for the Great White Brotherhood and the Ascended Masters. She lived it every day. I think at what point, again, there are plenty of people in mental health hospitals who believe that they have these grandiose roles. I'm not necessarily saying that she was mentally ill, although she did have epilepsy, but she was someone who actually believed in this grandiose story. What do you call that? What is that? You would know better than I.
There is a lot at play. And when we talk about this kind of epilepsy, too, it's a specific kind of epilepsy. If people want to hear more about some studies that were done, to check out the studies of Yuval Laor, who did study this form of epilepsy that causes people to think they really are communing with something spiritual. And that when the seizure, that episode ends, they kind of come to, which is interesting. What I found really interesting about these personalities, and I don't mean to call your mom a personality, but just to study what I think may have been true for her, is that there are some people who are really caught up in their own myth, like you're saying, often with a narcissistic bent. They're more of these social narcissists. They need to feed off of others. They will do it in tandem with others. And then they can start to believe that they have superhuman powers, sometimes because it originates from them, or it's because of the interplay that they know they're Pied Pipers. They say something, people listen. They go somewhere, people follow. And then if they say, I have these special powers and people believe them, then they're being fed back. It's this loop. They're being fed back this idea of their prowess and their abilities being superhuman, which then reinforces the message for them internally, and it just keeps going. I also think that because there is a diagnosis called folie à deux, which is shared psychosis, there are a lot of people who will say after they came out of a cultic system that they felt that their brain had been scrambled, but they felt like they entered into the disorder or whatever it was, psychosis, of the person in charge, very similar to when we study Heaven's Gate, people like the leader of Heaven's Gate, who I think had different psychiatric issues, people joined in with the idea of the mothership coming and not wanting to take in the fact that there was no proof of it. And when they bought a telescope and they directed it at the comet, there was no mothership, so they were sure the telescope was broken. It's very interesting how we, as Dr. Margaret Sanger used to say, you learn to deny the evidence of your senses when you're in these systems, right? It's a fantastic way of looking at it. So I think they're in it with people. They jump into the disorder and it just makes it bigger and bigger and bigger until the person will often implode because that's not sustainable.
I think what I talk about in my book is that the cultic system between leader and follower, it's not transitive. A lot of people think, well, the cult leader is manipulating these people, is all the different accusations that this is a transitive act, but it's interactive. It's interactive. It's a system. And I think that also, as I was talking about earlier about the charisma, it's like a loop that goes back and forth and keeps getting reinforced. I recently wrote an article called Jesus is a Sock Puppet. What I meant by that is that Jesus becomes a projection of whoever a person is. If you're a kind, compassionate person, you're going to believe in a kind, compassionate Jesus. If you're an angry, vindictive person, you're going to believe in the judgmental Jesus and the one who is smiting people. And I think that's also true with channels. You're going to channel a master that is like you, if you believe there are even any masters out there. But I was reading an article the other day, and they were talking about certain types of schizophrenia where people would hear one of their inner voices and believe it was coming from outside themselves. Now, I don't know if I'm getting that right in mental health terms, but it's a recursion. You believe you hear the voice of God or an ascended master, and it's your own voice getting recycled back to you and amplified because now you believe this came from outside yourself, that you're a part of something larger. And so now your certainty about what's true and what's right has just exploded 100-fold. God told me this, God told me that. And you hear the cadence rising. You hear these preachers, and it goes up and up and up. And that is the messianic certainty to convince themselves, I feel like.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's just an internal voice that got recycled and is now coming back. That's a theory I have about how these channeling sessions work.
Yeah. I mean, I think that they certainly can. You know, when you talk about these, some people have these warriors that they channel. Jay-Z Knight, I remember, had this warrior.
Ramtha,
right. Right, exactly. Exactly, right. How many people know about that? We have a lot of data in our heads that probably matches. But I think once you start thinking that you are communing with the ascended masters, with Buddha, with Muhammad, with God, all of it, I think there's something in us, you and me and a lot of others, most others, who if someone said, well, what do you think God wants or what do you think God says? You'd say, I can't say. I mean, that's not for me to say. That's a relationship that you have with God. Do you believe in God? I don't know. And there would be a lot of like hemming and hawing. But to get to that point where you're so sure and convinced that you have this channel, I think you need a different kind of personality. And you also need to build in something into your system where if it turned out to be wrong, that doesn't matter somehow. You still are protected because people can't question you. They'll assume that it wasn't wrong, that it was for some other reason or it was a test. They have other ways of making sure that they're still protected and still right and that people learn not to question. So I think cult leaders are really good at tying people's hands behind their back without people realizing that that's what's happening so that they can say or do whatever and no one will assume that they've lost their mind.
Well, when you talk about narcissism and you talk about ego, and I mentioned this at the beginning of the show, it's a little bit humbling to realize that you're subordinate to the truth. I don't get to decide what the universe is like. I can only acknowledge it. I don't have control over mortality. I don't have control over the future. I have to be somewhat humble, and cult leaders are anything but humble. They pump up their own ego. Comes a feedback loop with the egos of the people who are following them, who think that they're now important because they're in the presence of this important cult leader. And it just keeps growing and growing. Where's the check or balance on that power? It's a loop. It has to be broken. And when it finally is broken, then everybody kind of looks around and goes like, why did we ever fall for that? I keep waiting for that to happen with Trump. I don't know when that's going to happen, but this has been a 10-year going on 11-year nightmare now with this guy.
It's incredible. I think what's also true is that there are a lot of people who are now having buyer's remorse because they're seeing things that somehow they weren't expecting.
Even though everybody told them.
Right. Everyone told them. And everyone also told them that there were going to be things that were going to go beyond, that they were going to go beyond anything that you could even expect. But just to expect that. There's just so much chaos that you just can't keep up with it. I think the loop that we're talking about, too, also includes when people leave, there's something wrong with them.
Always.
Right. So
always.
Then there's no insight. Oh, it seems that everyone's leaving, or everyone seems unhappy, or people are starving.
Those are betrayers. Those are traitors. And that's as far as it ever gets. Because if you question, then you belong with them. You become the traitor. You become the betrayer. So it just sharpens the in-group versus out-group all the time. It's like every day it's getting sharper and sharper. And then you have MAGA. Now, suddenly MAGA isn't enough. It has to be ultra-MAGA. You narrow the core of the believers who are so fanatical that they would kill or die for the leader. Eventually, you get to that point.
Yeah, that's when it gets very frightening. Like, it's not already. But it can still get to that point. And there might be people already there. I'm wondering to just toggle back to when you left, how that was seen, like how old were you and how was that dealt with and what were you worried? Maybe you weren't worried about what you were going to be seen as or called, but I'm just curious about that transitional time for you.
Yeah, well, I actually left two different times because the first time, it's kind of a long involved story, but the first time I left was when I was about 20. It was basically just because the woman I was in love with at the time, who I later married and had three kids with, my mother was trying to ban me from seeing her. And so I just said, I'm out of here. She kicked her out, actually. And so I said, well, you kick her out, you're kicking me out too. So we left together for a couple years. And then that's right around the time when the prophecies became more and more intense. And Los Angeles was supposedly unsafe, going to fall into the ocean or whatever the hell it was, or be nuclear bombed. I ended up coming back into the cult, leaving Los Angeles. And again, this is probably going to bore some listeners just to hear this convoluted story, but I did go back into the cult for another 7 years. And that's when the whole bomb shelter debacle happened. You know? And the world was supposed to end, and then it didn't. During that time, when I came back into the cult, I was appointed vice president. So I was actually a cult leader for about 7 years.
Oh, that's so interesting. And by the way, with the people who listen to this podcast, these are the stories that they are going to relate to, because for a lot of them listening, they went through similar things. They were pulled back in, or they felt like they were supposed to somehow have a role, or they were anointed in some way to, I think, keep a hold on them. So a lot of people are going to relate to this part. It's not going to be boring at all.
Okay. Okay.
So yeah, so go
well,
for it.
In my book, I call my first time out, I call it Rumspringa, because I'm kind of referring to how young Amish people, they're allowed, encouraged to leave for a little while and come back. That's what it ended up being for me. I basically took a 2-year, I thought when I first left, it's like, I'm out for good, but I hadn't escaped mentally. And so when these prophecies started to get more and more intense, I started to get scared. I was literally afraid. When I finally agreed to go back in, I had met with my mother at the beach. So I had driven out to Malibu. We talked on the beach. It's when I agreed to go back. And on my way home, I'm literally visualizing in my mind these giant tsunamis washing over the Malibu Hills. And I believe these things were absolutely factual, more concrete than any physical reality. So even though I didn't want to go back in the cult, and I was really sad to be leaving Los Angeles because I love Los Angeles, I just could not get away from these apocalyptic visions that she had painted, that I was starting to now, I didn't sound like I saw them, but I was imagining. The imagination took over from her prophecies and started to become a part of my imagination. So I'm imagining all of this disaster happening to this city. And it's like, well, I love the city, but I don't want to be here when that happens, you know? So I went to Chicago where I was ordained a minister in the cult. And I started to lead services and tend to our congregation in Chicago while I was going to school. And so that was in 87. Through 87 and 88, I was at second and third year at Northwestern. Then summer session of 88 is when I dropped out to go and go back and build the bomb shelters. And again, it was my belief, even though, you know, one part of me was saying, well, you really should finish college. Another part of me was saying, well, if the world is going to end, what good is college? I want to be a part of this shelter building effort because I want to make sure it's done right because I'm going to have to live in these things. So I decided to go back and do that. And I ended up working on the electrical systems for the shelters, which were extremely elaborate.
Wow. Right. So I remember the late 80s being the time of this prediction and then also devastation. So often, like with Jehovah's Witnesses predicting the end of the world and then, oh, our bad. And then over and over again, it does a number on people's psyches, but also it does a number on people's sense of adherence to an organization that got this wrong. But I also understand your fear. And when you are given these visions, it's hard to shake them. And you want to be able to do what you can to be a part of keeping yourself and the people you care about safe. And so were there a lot of other people when you were working on the shelters? Were there a lot of other people there with you?
I think we had about 10 or 15 people just in the engineering and planning department. When it came to construction, there ultimately were about 200, 250 people who worked on this project for a couple of years. It was massive. I mean, it was gigantic. This shelter complex, you can see it from satellite. It's on Google Earth. It was about 1,800 feet long, room for 700 people to live underground, and food storage for 7 years. It was very elaborate. I mean, we basically took all of our assets that we had built up over 30 plus years of operation at that time and sunk them into the ground. I mean, we had almost nothing left after that.
Incredible. The point that you left was when? What happened that was the catalyst? I'm sure there were a lot of things, but what was the main catalyst?
Well, there were a lot of things. I mean, certainly the kind of night when it was all supposed to happen, the nuclear war was supposed to happen. That day, my mom took my sister and I aside, and she, instead of us trying to prevent this calamity from occurring, she reframed the whole thing like, now this needs to happen. This is the judgment of humanity, the judgment of the world for rejecting God's messenger and for rejecting the teachings. And so we were actually praying for this war to happen. Because not only was it a spiritual judgment, we had physically committed ourselves, all the resources of the organization, we wouldn't be able to pay our bills if this didn't happen. So we were committed to it on multiple levels, spiritually, physically, financially, 100% all in to this calamity. And so once I heard her chanting in favor of the bombs descending, that kind of shook me because I was like, this could kill billions of people. What are we doing here? When it didn't happen, then the reframing always starts because every millenarian organization always has an answer for what happens when the prophecy fails. And usually it's along the lines of the Lord works in mysterious ways. In our case, it was we have prevented this calamity through our prayers, which made no sense because we were praying for it to happen. It was like a double flip. First, we're trying to prepare to survive this terrible thing. Now we want it to happen. Oh, but now we saved the world because it didn't happen. So if you can imagine people following along with that level of twisted logic, a lot didn't. After the prophecies failed, I'd say probably between a third and a half of people left within 6 months or a year. So I stuck around for a few years longer because I let myself get a little, first of all, I was vice president and I was in management. I let myself get carried away with what I thought we could do, we could become. I wanted to become something better. I thought maybe we could become a little bit less of a cult. My family's there. Everybody I know is there. So after the shelter thing died down, I started, I don't know, thinking maybe I would stay, but things started to fall apart. I feel like it was kind of tough to justify me being there for a few more years after my mom called for 2 billion people to die. That's the estimate of what a global nuclear war would do, is kill like 2 billion people. So I feel like I kind of should have left right after that. I stuck around longer because I thought we had a chance to maybe reform the organization to begin to be less of a cult and more of a commercial enterprise, that we could offer value for, I don't know, educational products for the homeschool market. We could offer things that would actually justify our existence instead of just being this cult. But what started to happen is there were cracks personally between me and my mom. There were a couple of events that happened where I saw her using dictations to further her personal agenda. Things that had been discussed outside of a spiritual context suddenly are coming out in dictations. And so it's like, that's when I first started to think, well, Mom, that's just you talking. It's not some master here. You were just talking about that the other day. Now it's coming out in a dictation. And this particular thing had to do with near beer. And it seems like a crazy thing to lose my faith about. But it was, in fact, there was this petty community dispute where some of the conservative moms didn't like seeing beer bottles in trash can. It's like, well, alcohol was banned, but this was non-alcoholic beer. Now it's still going to be banned because it was upsetting to some people. And so I didn't really care that much about that. But when I heard, because I'd heard my mother and sister talking about, well, it's probably not a good idea for people to have the vibration of beer in our community kind of thing. And then it comes out in a dictation. This was just a decision that they made on their own. And then she's claiming it for the master. The master El Moria says that you cannot have near beer. So that bothered me. And then there was another thing that bothered me, which is that I was trying to get health insurance because at that point I had just had my third child. And so family of five, no health insurance. So my mom is saying to me, well, if you have any medical problems, we'll pay for it. I'm like, well, I'm vice president of this organization. I have a family. I don't have to beg you for medical bills. She wouldn't agree to it. She wouldn't agree to me getting health insurance because nobody had health insurance. So she figured if she allowed me to have health insurance, why is her staff of hundreds of people also not having health insurance? The health insurance was a big deal. That was actually finally when I said, I'm being forced right now to choose between the health of my family and loyalty to my mother. At that point, I was done.
And she wasn't acting like grandma, right? Like,
no, these are her grandkids. Don't you want them to have insurance? And it's so funny how this came full circle, because we still don't have a national health plan that covers everyone. Who knew that this problem that I had in my cult back in 1993 or whatever would become such a national problem? And then the huge giant battle over Obamacare and whether we're going to have universal care. We're the only country in the world practically that doesn't have it. And the human suffering that that has caused is insane. It's insane. The irony is not lost on me that this is the reason why I left my cult, was health insurance.
Wow. Wow. That is quite intense. I want to go back to something you were saying about staying on and really wanting the group to be something useful, helpful, practical in people's lives. That is actually a very common thing. Sometimes people will say, our group would have been great if we had just gotten the leaders to leave and we could run it in a way that was sort of led by our own conscience and connecting with each other and seeing what the other person needed, not from what was dictated from on high. That seemed kind of disconnected. But also there are a lot of people, for example, there are a lot of Scientologists, they call themselves indies, and they might have other names for it too, who believe in certain parts of it, but don't believe in the organization. And they think those things are still helpful. So they want to promote those things. They don't want to throw everything away. They want to, here are all these people who care. Let's see if we can do something good with this. And it's a way also, it's like people's conscience is showing through. This is who I am. I really want to do good things. And then you find out at some point that there is not the ability to do that within the system as it is, which can be depressing to find out about.
I think everybody has to go through a sort of death of their illusions. You have to go through that first before you can get out of a cult. And I think the idea, this is a phrase that I hear constantly from cult defenders and apologists, which is, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I hate that phrase now, because show me what part you think is baby and what part is bathwater. They never specify what that is. And so it's like, you say, okay, the principles were good. Scientology principles were good, whatever it is. Are they? Or do you just think they're good because you're still in the cult. You're still subject to thought reform. You're still using these thought-stopping cliches, because I don't know that much about Scientology, but something about engrams or whatever it is, which was very much our concept of discarnate entities. These things, thetans, that are making you do things that you don't really want to do, it's all nonsense. It's all absolute nonsense. These are stand-ins for psychology, for understanding your psychology. That's why Scientologists hate psychologists.
Among a lot of other reasons, but yes, that is one of the reasons. And it is true. These are stand-ins. That's a really, really important way to look at that. I think, yeah, also, I remember learning a lot about different phrases and where the phrase, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, came from. It's actually kind of gross where that all came from. Look at it. I'll just say it briefly. There was this idea they didn't understand about children and their need for things being clean, and that if you were lucky enough to get fresh water, the adults, usually the male, would bathe first, and then every successive person, as it got younger and younger, would then bathe until the water was filthy. And so if you threw away the bathwater, you didn't know if the baby was still in it sometimes, which is,
oh my God,
just a horrible notion.
It is horrible. It is horrible. It's like the origins of Rockabye Baby. Yeah, but there's all these
horrible things.
Or right, Ring Around the Rosie.
Right? Uh-huh. Yeah, right. Exactly.
But the point is that there is no baby when it comes to cults.
Yeah.
It's all bathwater. It all needs to be thrown out. Cult apologetics is really bad, because not only does it keep cult leaders in business, but it keeps abuse victims from healing. You've got this trauma. If you can't acknowledge the trauma that happened, if you can't name it properly, if you can't face that you were a part of something destructive, then you're never going to heal. So as long as you're trying to protect something, it's like, well, it wasn't all bad. Well, which part was good? You got to be responsible for what you're saying. If you want to try to defend something, which part was good?
Right. Oh, I'm so glad you brought this up, because I do think, right, there is this sort of idea of this transitional object. I don't want to get rid of everything. I still need to hold on to some things that helped me during my transition, so that I don't have to see it all as having been wrong or made up and not necessary in my life. I'm not quite ready to look at that, so I want to hold on to things being salient or having credibility, which is so interesting. People will hold on to that for quite some time.
I'm not saying that this has to happen all at once. I mean, sometimes it takes years to go through the whole process, but you ultimately, that's where you have to get. As long as you are trying to protect some part of it or protect some value, even I know that a lot of people will say, well, I made the best friends I ever made in my life came from the cult. It's like, well, yeah, but if you had been somewhere else, you would have made different friends and they would have been just as good. Having an intensive communal group, it makes you believe and feel that you're living like your life is bigger, larger, more important than normal people. So you get this inflated sense that these relationships are something more than they are. But relationships form wherever humans gather. It doesn't have to be any specific reason or group.
Wow. So many interesting points. And I'm thinking also just with building bomb shelters, when you are in the trenches together and you're fighting against something together.
It's like war buddies.
Right, war buddies. You know, that you're connected for life. Even though the whole situation was fabricated, was created for a lot of reasons, but the end result is that you feel like these are your people, that you've lived through something together that wasn't ever going to happen, but you still think that you live. So interesting.
Trauma bonding.
Yeah. Wow. I really want people to be able to find out about how to be in touch with you, and also about your book, because there's so much in your book about what is prescient now. Yes, there it is. My Cult, Your Cult.
Yeah. So my book is My Cult, Your Cult, How Cults Destroy Truth and Bolster Authoritarian Power. This is available on Amazon, paperback, Kindle, and audiobook. I read the audiobook myself. It took me quite a while to do that, but I've told, I think on this program, maybe about 10% of what's in the book. So there's a lot of other interesting stories, a lot of theory in there. And also I write at Substack. It's called Exoprophet, EXOPROPHET. And on that site, I also have the PDF companion for the audiobook. So if somebody is interested, they can look at some of the pictures and illustrations from the book.
Fantastic. It is so timely in your book that you're going to cover so many issues that we're dealing with now, human rights, suppressing dissent, all of the things that are woven into the fabric, unfortunately, of our media today, our government today, our lives today. It is so important that you're getting this information out there and using your experience as this sort of launching pad for really important discussions. So thank you. Thank you for coming on today so that we could learn more about you and your life, but also what matters to you and what you want to educate people about. It's been a great discussion. Thank you.
Rachel, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
One more thing before you go. Thank you so much to Sean Prophet for all of his insights, for all that he shared about his life. I know that we were going back and forth between talking about his ideas about government, about the world, and I also really wanted to make sure that you got a glimpse of a little bit about his existence too, because what people don't know sometimes when they're talking to people who have been through these kinds of experiences is how much they've had to get past in order to just get where they are in their lives and to be able to give them due credit for that. There are a lot of times that I, you know, heard people talk about his parents who were running a very successful and ultimately very destructive cult. And to come from that legacy is not easy because, you know, you're still talking about mom and dad. And here you have Sean, who is very bright, very capable, and has needed to overcome so much. A lot of the teachings that I remember learning about early on, just about cultic systems, about how leaders work, about the kind of hypnotic trance-like states that people can be put in, you know, Sean's mom, Elizabeth Clare Prophet, was often used as an example for how people can take over a lot of people's thinkings. And his father as well, just talking about when he mentioned the thoughts that come up in his mind, the passages potentially from certain Bible passages or quotes about, you know, certain people, certain of the ascended masters, people who are the thought leaders, the spiritual thought leaders of our time, people who were considered saints or whomever else. These are the kinds of thoughts that not only he has that are going to be popping into his head, but almost everyone who has been involved in the Church Universal and Triumphant. Because these things were repeated over and over and over again, and it gets embedded. And it is important to know that if you were raised in an environment that has taught you things in a repetitive way, if that thought suddenly pops into your mind, it doesn't mean you're back there and it doesn't mean you miss it and it doesn't mean you need those teachings or if they were ever relevant or if they were ever necessary. They're just there. I think about the things I was taught when I was young and they're in my head, whether they're dangerous or not, whether they're religious or not. My mom liked to have things clean in the kitchen, which sometimes made cooking with her a little bit stressful, but it mattered to her. And so when I go in the kitchen and I'm making something, I have this phrase in my head, which is clean as you go, clean as you go. And people who I have ever lived with, even back to when I was in college, they'd say, what are you mumbling to yourself? And I'd say, I'm not even aware that I'm doing it, but I'm thinking clean as you go. So is that a necessary thought? I don't know. Probably leaves me with less of a mess later on, but it's not destructive per se. It's just there. So when you have these thoughts that are for your benefit, you think, or to keep you in line, or to make sure that you are staying a good person, or that by reciting these things, you're staying in good grace of the person who is in charge, it's going to be even harder to shake those things because you felt like you were supposed to hang on to them for your safety and for your social safety within that organization. So when people notice those things, when they notice cultic teachings, when they notice cultic verbiage in the words that they're using or the words that pop into their heads, again, it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. It just means your brain has the capacity to take on information that is presented to you in a repeated fashion and to have it stick. So it's important then to notice those things that suddenly pop into your head and to wonder out loud and to even speak to them and say, do I need you? Is this an important piece of information? And also to notice and to wonder, why was I taught this? Was this for my benefit or did this serve the people who were controlling me for me to believe that or for me to have those thoughts in my mind? There is something also that Sean talked about what gets people's attention. And this is also about sort of what gets stuck in our psyches. And he was saying that things that are simple and outrageous get people's attention. So if there are things that people who are getting involved in conspiratorial thinking or other kinds of belief systems are exposed to, if they seem simple to understand or they're just, you know, offered in a simple way, like just with a few words, but they're outrageous, people will lean in. People will wonder. People will also think that if someone who is in a position of authority has said this to me, there must be something to it. But also there might not be. And you always want to have that as a possibility. This could be this piece of information that I really, really need. And I would love for you to add this addendum to them, which is, or not. But let me not assume that it's important just because the person who said it to me is someone who I'm supposed to listen to or someone who calls themselves a channeler of ascended masters, someone who comes across like they know the truth. It still might not be that what they say is the truth. But also when you're growing up and in any kind of situation, you do think that what your parents tell you is the truth until you realize sometimes that they're wrong, until you realize sometimes that what they're telling you is said to you for a particular reason or through a particular bias, and it might not be so accurate. So the people who I've talked to, who are the children of, and sometimes the grandchildren of, or great-grandchildren of, the people who have been running cultic groups or started cultic groups, they have the need to believe in the teachings because that's the right way to believe. But they also have the natural need and desire to listen to their parents and to take on what they say as the truth. Undoing that and both those layers is not at all an easy thing to do. I like that Sean has been able to talk to us about also some of the fears that he was given and what drove him to get back involved in the group, that he was envisioning that there would be these tidal waves and they would be crashing over the coast. And he was so afraid for all of California, and he was afraid for the people there and the people on the beach and near the beach. When you're given these visions that are extreme, that are so disturbing, they do stick and they become part of your psyche. And you will wonder if these are things that are really going to happen. They also enter into your dreams, into your nightmares, and they really get under your skin. And sometimes you don't know that these things are not true until you notice that they just don't happen. So for all the people who were raised with these kinds of visions, including people who were raised with this idea of Armageddon, of the end of the world coming, of nuclear disaster. I remember being raised during a time when we were supposed to hide under our desks in school because that was going to protect us from nuclear war, and we needed to see Russia as this very, very scary foe, but this sort of nefarious kind of way of looking at a whole country of people who were plotting our demise. It wasn't until I was older that I thought, actually sitting under a desk made of composite wood is really not going to do the trick if there is any kind of nuclear war. But still, I remember having nightmares about that. And I remember feeling very, very scared and talking to friends about that, that it was something that was in this sort of kind of imminent nature, like this was going to be happening at any moment. And if someone had said to me at the time, hey, there's this group of people, or there's this place that you can go where you're going to be safe from this, I might have considered it if it really was something that I was very worried about and that my whole family was worried about, my whole community was worried about. We might have wanted to take steps to protect ourselves, because why not? So when people tell these stories of searching for communities, searching for safety, it is good to not think and wonder about the person themselves, like, what made them susceptible to this? And why are they so worried about these things? Or what makes their thinking paranoid? Or just not to put the focus on them, but instead to think, what created that in them? Who created that in them? And why? What did they have to gain from making people scared of this? That's where the focus should go. That's who the focus should be on. Thank you very much to Sean for all that he's done and all that he has written and all that he puts out to the public that helps us look at this in a micro way, seeing how people can really be affected and how he was personally affected, and also in a macro way, looking at the big picture, how this kind of thinking can permeate whole governmental systems and the media and the way we look at the world and the way we look at ourselves and the way we look at each other. Take good care. I will talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @IndoctrinationPodcast. And for Twitter, find us @@_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.